From Altoona to Grantham, Saxonburg to Jeffersonville, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, federal regulators are again planning to place restrictive new rules on small business loans. Kevin Shivers from the Pennsylvania Association of Community Bankers is here with details. Funding for mass transit systems is in flux as COVID-19 subsidies end and state funding changes. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have an Allegheny Institute report. And the situation at America's southern border has gotten worse. On this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary, Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania says it is time for a new comprehensive border security policy. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Kevin Shivers in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Party nominees have been selected for the high-profile open seat on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. In Tuesday's primary, Republicans nominated Montgomery County Common Pleas Court President Judge Carolyn Carluccio, while Democratic voters selected Philadelphia Judge Dan McCaffrey. Megan Martin defeated Josh Prince for the GOP nomination for a seat on the Commonwealth Court and will face Matt Wolf in the November general election. Maria Batista and Westmoreland County Judge Harry Smell Jr. will compete with Jill Beck and Tamika Lane for two seats on the statewide Superior Court. Meanwhile, Democrats held on to their slim one-seat lead in the state House of Representatives as Democrat Heather Boyd secured an open seat in Delaware County, while in a separate special election, the GOP's Michael Stender maintained a heavily Republican seat in Montour and Northumberland counties. Progressives continued their string of victories over traditional Democrats in Allegheny County on Tuesday as Socialist State Representative Sarah Inamorato prevailed in a six-way contest for the open Allegheny County executive seat. And Matt Dugan, whose campaign was mostly funded by George Soros, ousted incumbent Democrat Stephen Zapala in the race for Allegheny County District Attorney. At the other end of the state, former Democratic City Councilwoman Sherelle Parker won the nine-way primary for mayor of Philadelphia. Parker will face Republican nominee David O. in the November election. The city has not elected a Republican mayor since the 1950s, so Parker is considered a heavy favorite to become the city's first woman mayor. Pittsburgh's office vacancy rate grew worse in the first quarter of 2023 and will likely continue to do so for years, according to a new report published by the Allegheny Institute for Public Policy. In the fourth quarter of 2022, the office vacancy rate for all buildings in all classes in 54 office markets across the nation was 19.6%. For the Pittsburgh area, it was 21.3%. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Access to capital is vital for businesses to grow and expand, but proposed new federal regulations on the banking industry will make getting loans more difficult. Here with the details is Kevin Shivers. He is president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Association of Community Bankers. Longtime listeners to our program may recall Kevin as having been a regular panelist on our Capital Watch segment for many years. Kevin, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Kevin, the Biden administration, as they are doing in a number of areas, are looking to implement some new rules, new regulations, if you will, on bankers, and this could have a direct impact, particularly on small business. Give us an overview on what is being proposed here.
Your listeners may recall, you got to go back over a decade ago when Congress, which was controlled by the Democrats, the House, the Senate, the Obama administration, passed Dodd-Frank legislation. This was intended to push back against Wall Street. We started hearing about banks that were too big to fail, and this was part of a sweeping reform that was intended to protect consumers. And one of the things we've learned about Dodd-Frank legislation is that over the 15 years since it's been implemented, it has created a number of hurdles that have impacted consumers, that have hurt small banks, that have affected small business owners. We are now in one of the final vestiges of that law that is now being finalized by the Biden administration. there were provisions within that statute, the Dodd-Frank law, that would relate specifically to small business lending. And it would require banks to collect a whole lot of data about the small business borrowers that are coming in their doors. Now, remember, with small business owners, about 70% of them rely on a community bank, a small bank within their local hometown for their banking needs and for their capital needs. The idea of going in, getting a small business loan. Community banks, and those are banks under $10 billion in assets, historically are banks that provide 70% of small business lending. They do about 80% of the agriculture loans in America. So community banks are part and parcel, part of the fabric of small business operations in America. This rule would stick a wedge in between that relationship. It would require banks to collect some 21 different pieces of information about that small business borrower. Many of this rather intrusive. You would need to understand demographic information. And if you, as the business owner, did not supply this, the bank employee would be forced to take a guess. Things like gender, things like race, things like nationality, you know, all of those things that really shouldn't be part of the business decision of whether someone is being given a loan or awarded a loan. These are now data points that banks would be required to collect this information on the prospective borrower. What is more concerning, Loman, is that this federal rule would require the banks to publicly disclose this information so that competitors could find out financial information about the small business. They could, based on the type and size of loan, would be able to prognosticate investment decisions that could strategically hamper these businesses. And in addition to that, in the case of small businesses who may be rejected for a loan, that information would be made public in such a way that people within the community might be able to use the data and actually figure out the individual business that was rejected. That's akin to like posting the NSF check on the back of the bodega wall. You know, you don't want your friends and neighbors to know that you had a loan that was rejected. What is the net effect of all of this, Loman? It means that for many small businesses, rather than go to their local financial institution to borrow money to be able to expand their business, chances are they're probably going to run up the credit card a little bit more, a few thousand dollars more, go into debt with high interest rates. They may find alternative forms of lending which do not, that are not backed up in the same way that our traditional banking system is. Those interest rates may be much higher, higher fees, et cetera. And in fact, it may just discourage many entrepreneurs and small business owners from using the traditional banking system at all. Further, this may hinder community banks in areas where a small business owner would rather not have that information made public in a small bank. All right, I'll go to a large national bank where my data might disappear within the reams of information. So there is a real concern that this rule, 1071, as implemented by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau within the Biden administration, could harm small business entrepreneurs, their ability to lend, could bury community banks under reams of paperwork, and just create a whole lot of unnecessary privacy issues that could hamper the economic growth in Pennsylvania across the country.
We are talking with Kevin Shivers, who is president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Association of Community Bankers, talking about new rules from the Biden administration and taking a look at these proposed rules or rules that apparently are coming down the pike here. Kevin, does Congress have any sort of a say or role in perhaps stopping or mitigating the damage?
Well, recently, Congressman Dan Muser in Pennsylvania, who serves on the U.S. House Small Business Committee, recently held a hearing and invited lenders from Pennsylvania and also across the country to share their concerns about this legislation. And it was an eye-opener that many of these small business lenders, these community banks, talked about the difference for them is, we call it relationship banking, and that oftentimes being able to, you know somebody in the community, you know they're an upstanding citizen, you know they have a really good idea. The credit rating might not be stellar, but they are someone who it's worth the risk to invest in them, and you know they're going to do something well with that loan. The concern here with this particular rulemaking is that you're going to bury that individual borrower under a landmine's worth of data that, you know, they're going to have to collect a whole host of information that a lot of borrowers are simply not going to want to offer. And as well, there is going to be implications on those bankers because, you know, there's a cost that goes into that type of rulemaking. And the real question is, what is the CFPB going to do with this data once they collect it? There are a whole host of privacy concerns. I mean, there's a lot of information that the small business borrower is going to have to give up as part of this process to get a loan. So Representative Muser, through his committee, had a chance to hear some real concerns among these small business lenders, such that there were recommendations made, and now there is legislation proposed, a resolution through the Small Business Committee that would urge Congress to set aside this particular rulemaking and as well to go back and to eliminate these really onerous reporting requirements that would force a banker to guess on the nationality, the gender, the racial demographics of the individual borrowers, as well that would prohibit the publication of this financial information somewhere where a business competitor could actually identify the borrower through the data that's released and ultimately learn a little bit more, give them a competitive disadvantage over that person that is just trying to access some capital to grow their company.
Isn't this, Kevin, just one more roadblock being thrown in the way of small business? As we look back over the last year, of course, the Fed has raised interest rates a number of times in an effort to fight Biden inflation. And now you want to have this. Are we seeing a situation developing here where small businesses, Kevin, are having more and more difficulty accessing the capital they need to sustain and grow their businesses?
Loman, this is just another example of the Biden administration just pounding hard on those small business borrowers, the small business owners. We have just finished the COVID emergencies where many small businesses were forced to shut their doors. Many of them were not given opportunities to open back up because they lost their employees, they lost the capital that they had. Some of these folks are now starting new business ventures, and these rules that are being proposed by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau at the absolute worst time could discourage those entrepreneurs from applying for those small business loans for fear that the information about the company, about themselves, is going to be made public in a way that their friends and neighbors and business competitors might learn about them. And then the shame that goes along with perhaps someone's loan rejection being made public for those in the community to see. I agree with you. I think this is going to discourage many small businesses from even accessing capital. They're going to go back to the credit card and maybe eke out a few thousand extra dollars on that line of credit at an extraordinarily high interest rate. And that's not good for the small business economy. That's not good for the American economy.
Kevin Shivers, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Association of Community Bankers. Kevin, tell us a little bit about the Association of Community Bankers, and also where can folks go if they want to learn more about your association and this issue?
Thank you, Loman. That Pennsylvania's Association of Community Bankers is designed to promote the value and the virtues of community banking in Pennsylvania. You can learn more by visiting pacb.org. What defines community banking? Well, those are local deposits that are invested in small businesses and home ownership in that local community. So it's your money being put to work to benefit your local community. Our role is to help to advance those issues and concerns that can empower community bankers to make a positive impact in those local communities that they serve.
Kevin Shivers from the Pennsylvania Association of Community Bankers. Kevin, thank you for being back with us.
Thank you.
Mass transit systems across Penn's Woods are bracing for the end of COVID-19 subsidies and are dealing with changing state revenue subsidies. Here to sort through the details are Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi with an Allegheny Institute report.
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm your host, Frank Gamrat, and with me today is Allegheny Institute Research Director Eric Montardi. Recently, you tackled a pretty weighty issue, and that is transportation funding, specifically mass transportation funding, because as your brief showed, and you can read this brief on our website at AlleghenyInstitute.org, there was a drop in funding to PennDOT from the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission. Some of that funding went to mass transit, and of course, not everyone liked that, so there have been some issues on how to replace it. Could you please provide our listeners with a little background on where the state money came from that propped up mass transit for the last 15 years or so?
Under Act 44, 2007, when, as you've written many times, the state had planned on tolling I-80 and using that money to spend on transportation projects across the state, that plan fell through. The backup was to make the Turnpike make a $450 million payment to PennDOT, and $420 million of that went to what's called the Public Transportation Trust Fund. And that trust fund's made up of transfer of sales tax money, turnpike money, a bunch of fees on motor vehicles that are permitted by state law to be used for public transportation, and then some other transfers from other funds. When Act 89 came along in 2013, it put an end to the $420 million transfer. It said it was going to end in 2022-2023's fiscal year, and then there would be money made up by a transfer of sales and use tax on motor vehicles, trailers, semi-trailers. We are currently in that fiscal year now, and the money that is in the Public Transportation Trust Fund has now shifted between those two sources. The Turnpike's money transfer went from $420 million to $50 million. The sales tax transfer went from around $500 or $600 million up to $1.1 billion. That transfer presumably is going to happen going into the future.
So what have some of the transit agencies done? The biggest ones in the state, of course, are SEPTA and here PRT. What have they done, or what are they advocating that we do?
They had advocated for, in two reports that were done by PennDOT and the Turnpike Commission and those transit authorities, looking at a local generated options that essentially the state legislature would give permission to the counties and or other municipalities to maybe put surtaxes, fees, tax things that had not been taxed already, and use that money to support mass transit. Mentioned the transfer of the money in the Public Transportation Trust Fund between the Turnpike and the sales and use tax has happened, but now the transit authorities see the end coming to the federal COVID aid, and at least in SEPTA's case, they have said going into their budget year, they feel that when the money is gone, there will be a void, and that's going to have to be either be filled by service cuts and or fare hikes. The transit agencies are advocating for new sources of money that most likely would come from their counties.
And obviously, this is going to have to wind up to the Pennsylvania legislature because they're the ones that allow counties, municipalities, et cetera, to levy taxes. So what is the legislature proposing?
The proposal that's in Harrisburg now is allowing specific counties, and that would be Philadelphia, Allegheny, Montgomery, Bucks, Lancaster, Delaware, and Chester counties. So seven altogether out of the 67 counties. And that covers, with the exception of Lancaster County, would cover SEPTA and then PRT. For the counties, that if this legislation were to pass, that would enable counties to tax things like Uber and Lyft rides, that there would be an assessment upon them. There would be a surtax on personal income. There would be a surtax on sales and use. There would be the ability to double the $5 fee that was put in place to fund transportation infrastructure. So it's a little bit broader than just mass transit, but it's a fee that many counties have tacked on to automobile registration, and then that money goes into a special fund that the counties then use for transportation repairs and infrastructure. It would allow a personal property tax on motor vehicles, which that's never really existed in Pennsylvania. That would be something completely new. If the legislation were to pass and the counties were to adopt some, all of those proposed, they would put the money into a fund, and then that would be used to either support the mass transit agency that serves those counties or for transportation projects within those counties through grants and agreements that the counties would make.
So they're going to give the counties basically a menu of items to choose from, and they can choose a tax what they would like. Here in Allegheny County, we sort of have gone through a little bit of this a bunch of years ago. Can you tell our listeners, what does Allegheny County do differently to help fund mass transit?
Allegheny County has two taxes that were permitted by Act 44 in 2007. They tax alcoholic beverages and they tax car rentals. Those two revenue sources go into what's called the Transit Support Fund. This year, they're budgeted at a combined $49.5 million, and that money is used to match what the state of Pennsylvania subsidizes or grants to PRT. So the state money comes from the Public Transportation Trust Fund, and then the local match comes from the county via those two taxes. The additional part of that is that for the last 10 years, there's a portion of the sales and use tax that Allegheny County does levy, which is a bit of a complex formula, but part of it goes to something called the Regional Asset District, which funds parks, libraries, and other cultural amenities within the county. And what it did in 2013 was determine that a PRT qualified to become a regional asset. So out of their pool of money, they give a $3 million annual grant to PRT. And that, again, then matches with the drink tax and the car rental tax money that the county has in order to match the state money.
So we've already gone through this here on our side of the state. What recommendations do you make in the brief? What would be in the best interest of taxpayers that these transit agencies do going forward?
It'd be nice to see a piece of legislation that would end the right of transit workers to strike. That's something that's in the Second Class County Port Authority Act. That has a significant impact on the costs of PRT service. That is something that PRT itself points out in its annual reports when it's looking at how much it costs per trip or per hour on its modes of mass transit it provides to the public when it compares to other peer agencies around the country. The other thing, if this is, again, a little bit broader for the transportation infrastructure aspect of this legislation, is the change prevailing wage. That is something, again, that drives up the cost when you're talking about repairing roads, construction project, and how that leads to increased cost for taxpayers. This is just a menu of options. The big picture, again, would it even be something that if the counties were to adopt it, would that lessen the burden of what the state puts in to mass transit? I don't think it's a revenue neutral proposal. It's essentially, as you mentioned, a menu of options that if counties were given the ability to do it, would choose what they want to adopt.
That's fascinating stuff to say the least, and something that everyone needs to keep an eye on, because we all fund mass transit even if we don't use mass transit. I'd like to thank my colleague Eric for joining me today. I would like to thank our listeners for tuning in. If you'd like more information on this or other topics, I invite you to visit our website at AlleghenyInstitute.org. Thank you very much.
A comprehensive border security policy is needed to get control of the chaos at America's southern border. So says Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Americans for Prosperity Foundation has embarked on a first-of-its-kind project to bring activists from each of our state chapters to the southern border, where they can experience the reality on the ground, unfiltered and unadulterated. The first trip occurred April 26, where folks from Iowa, Nevada, and North Carolina visited McAllen, Texas. They had the opportunity to participate in a briefing by U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, tour portions of the border wall and well-traveled routes near the Rio Grande, and meet people on the ground who are experiencing the crisis on a daily basis. Without boots on the ground, it's tough to grasp the magnitude of what a 2,000-mile-long southern border demands by way of security. There was a common refrain from our activists. First, 19,000 officers are simply not enough to deal with the influx of people crossing the border. Second, what's occurring is a humanitarian disaster. And third, that this is an American issue, not a partisan issue. There's a new variable in the conversation around immigration policy, the termination of Title 42 on May 11th. In response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the CDC delegated power to the CBP to rapidly expel immigrants both at and between ports of entry, rather than process them under normal immigration procedure. The immediate effect of ending Title 42 will be an increase in apprehensions. At AFP, we believe that addressing the problems caused by our outdated, broken immigration system requires enhancing border security. We need an all-of-the-above border security strategy that includes four specific facets. First, barriers in strategic locations, modernized technology and infrastructure, and increases and retention of personnel. Second, facilitating opportunities to apply for protection outside the U.S. to reduce pressure at the border. Third, hiring more immigration judges and asylum officers and instituting last-in, first-out during migration surges to ensure timely and proper consideration of asylum claims while dissuading weak or frivolous claims. And fourth, increasing legal pathways and streamlining existing ones so migrants have more options than applying for asylum. Border security efforts should allow our federal government to focus on establishing safety, security, and order by defending us from those that present risks to national security and our rule of law. A CBS report from the mid-1980s called our policies around migrants and refugees, quote, immigration anarchy full of holes and hypocrisy. Well, three decades have passed, and the same can still be said. It is time for real solutions to be debated and advanced. We encourage you to sign the petition at afpfbordertour.com, which will allow you to stay up to date on opportunities for border visits and to keep informed about policy proposals and action at the federal level so you can best lobby your member of our Pennsylvania delegation of Senators Casey and Fetterman and 17 members of the U.S. House of Representatives. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania. You can connect with us on Facebook by searching at PAAFP and can follow us on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 28 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WERG-FM at Gannon University in Erie, WPXZ-FM, and WKQL-AM in Punxsutawney, along with WJAS-AM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal, plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.